The emblem for this in the 17th century was a hand which came from behind a stage curtain. And the hand is usually in an offering mode. And sometimes there's something in the hand. Sometimes like a torch of liberty is in the hand. Sometimes, in the best of them, there's just the pointing finger. And in the superlative, very best, it's an open hand that is there. There's a residue of this in the contemporary tarot deck. Aces, you'll find this hand coming from a cloud. The original image, the image eternelle, was not the hand from a cloud, but the hand from the wing of the stage. Because it was an Elizabethan English stage mind and consciousness which brought this step into being. Whatever is characteristic of that person who brings this into being becomes the actual structure for the archetypal form of the image. And of course, there are generations of people who are just unknowing of this, ignorant of this, and what passes into common usage is a fourth and fifth hand derivation. And of course, because of human nature being the way it is, people become extremely prideful of the fact that they have all kinds of so-called correlations for these images and can make these symbols tell all kinds of things. And they have no idea of where they really came from and have the arrogance to suppose that no one knows. And that because no one knows, they can talk freely and make up whatever seems right to them and whatever correlates with a couple of books that they've read. Well, the time for pulling plugs is here, and a lot of dirty water is going to go down the drain. There are those who understand and who can teach it accurately. So this presenting is necessary. But before the presenting can happen, there must be a disillusionment. And the major disillusionment that we must see is that, in a very simple way, Greece and India are sibling civilizations and are not the creative other encounter. And when we come back from the break, I'll start off with the theme of Shiva and Dionysus. Because Shiva and Dionysus, some 3,700 years ago, were the very same mythic figure in a cognate civilization. Shiva and Dionysus are the same mythic image. Exactly. Let's take a break now. Thank you. This is Yevgeny Yevtushenko's monologue of a Broadway actress, and it's read on record here, a record made some long while ago. This was from his San Francisco and New York poetry readings, concerts, and the reader is the actress Vivica Lindfors. And the text of the poem appears in a collection of Yevtushenko's poetry called Stolen Apples. I think it's in print, in paperback. And this is necessary so that we don't form a mispolarized idea of what a role is. A role is not something bad. A role is something structural. And we must understand that roles are essential. What is unessential are the bit parts other people give us. So here's the monologue of a Broadway actress And Vivica Lindfors does a very good job. It's going to blast you.
Now, here's a frame of distance that I very much admire called Procession with the Madonna.
Let's see, I thought it was the third one. Here it is. Come and sit on my chair.
Set an actress from Broadway. Time has pillaged like Troy. There are simply no more roles, no role to extract from me, all my tears to turn me inside. From this life, really, one must flee to the desert. There are simply no more roads. Broadway blazes like a hot computer. But believe me, there's no role, not one role, amidst hundreds of parts. Honestly, we are drowning in rolelessness. Where are the great writers? Where? The poor classics have broken out in sweat, like a team of tumblers whose axe is too long. What do they know about Hiroshima? What about the murder of the 6 million? About all our pain. Is it really all so inexpressible? Not one role, it's like being without a compass. You know how dreadful the world is when it builds up inside you, builds up, and there's absolutely no way out for it. Oh, there are road companies. For that matter, there are TV series. But they put you up with parts because the roads have been removed. I drink. Yes. I know it is weak of me. But what can you do when there are no more people, no more roads? Somewhere a worker is drinking from a glass or cake with greasy fingerprints. He has no role. A farmer is drinking, bellowing like a mule, because he is impotent. He has no role. A 16-year-old child is stabbed with a switch knife by his friends because they have nothing better to do. There are no roads. And without some sort of road, life is simply a slow rot. Oh, in the womb, we are all geniuses. But potential geniuses become idiots without a role to play, without demanding anyone's blood. I do demand a role.
Thank you. I think it makes the point, and you can see how poetry, one of the assignments that we've been working on here, is humanly accurate in its expression. So when we talk today about roles, when we're making a mask of a role, there's no derisive tone to this. You're not making a mask of something you're going to throw away. You're not making it as an exorcism of something that you don't like being trapped in, although it certainly has that kind of a quality. It's almost inevitable that we are not seen in our real human aspect, but only in the role. Most of you see me in the role of the teacher who sits in the chair, and the man is not seen at all. But in everyone's life, there is this kind of a condition. So the making of the mask of a role is not to get rid of it, but to be conscious that it is an essential structure. And when consciousness is able to inform itself about this, a freedom ensues, which is necessary, so that we choose more wisely the roles we do want to play and reject more confidently the bit parts others want to assign to us. And a great dialogue occurs between persons who, conscious of their roles, are not busy subconsciously trying to assign bit parts to you to complement their search for a role. This is a very difficult situation. Now I'm going to come to Reisman and build up towards Shiva and Dionysus. The Lonely Crowd by David Reisman was published by Yale University Press in 1950. From the preface, this is a book about character in the contemporary scientific sense of social character, the patterned uniformities of learned response that distinguish men of different regions, eras, and groups. It is a book about the nature of the processes that produce the differences in character of Americans, Frenchmen, Pueblo Indians, and so on, of Northern Americans and Southern Americans, of middle-class Americans and lower-class Americans. Furthermore, it is a book about the way in which certain social character types, once they are formed at the knee of society, are then deployed in the work, play, politics, and child-rearing activities of adult life. In other words, there's a mythic matrix with mythic images are forged and made. And when they are made, they are real, and they continue to be real and to operate. And they do exactly what they were meant to do. Even if the situation changes, they still do exactly what they were meant to do. The mythic image never modifies itself. Which is why if your search leads you to try to find a myth of your life and then live it, you're heading for the pit. Reisman. The first few chapters deal with the hypothesis that changes in population and technology everywhere are the chief correlates of changes in the social character. Population in the sense not just of numbers but of demography. Technology in the actual ritual use of tools made by science. Then the character and destiny of the middle and upper middle class America of yesterday and today are scrutinized. My major thesis in these opening chapters is that the conformity of earlier generations of America of the type I term inner directed was mainly assured by their internalization of adult authority. The most convenient hook for that is the Puritan self or the Protestant work ethic. The middle class urban American of today, however, is other directed. is, by contrast, in a characterological sense, more the product of his peers. That is, in sociological terms, his peer groups, the other kids at school or in the block. In adult life, he continues to respond to these peers, not only with overt conformity, as do people in all times and places. Note here, it always happens. Note here, it's the knack, the trick, is not to forbid this from happening, but to be conscious that in fact it does happen, but it's not the whole show. But also in a deeper sense, in the very quality of his feeling, where does it register? Where do the mythic images register? In feelings, in feeling tone. Yet, paradoxically, he remains a lonely member of the crowd because he never really comes close to the others or to himself. His inner-directed predecessor was lonely too, but in a different way, his chief company being the ancestors within, the parents whom he had internalized. To the reader who is familiar with Eric Fromm's treatment of the role of social character types in the historical process, this approach will not present difficulties. Our principal reliance has been on the concepts he has done so much to develop. On the other hand, it should present no great difficulties to the everyday reader, especially perhaps the reader of novels and drama, who is aware of salient differences between his generation and that of his father and grandfather. The terms I use for these ideal types, in Max Weber's sense, will be defined in their proper place, but I should like to warn the reader lest his judgment be prejudiced by the term inner-directed, which apart from the definition sounds like a more autonomous and therefore better type than other-directed. Notice again, it was being talked about as a distinction which is structural and is not weighted in terms of good and bad. To misunderstand this is very serious. To rebel against being other-directed because you want to be inner-directed is just as precarious as wanting to rebel against being inner-directed because you want to open up to the external situation. Both versions, both paths, yield further complications in the polarity. It's being on the horns of the dilemma. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Because the resolution is not in those terms. The resolution is in the wider field, the arena of the whole picture, of the complete pattern. It's essential to keep reminding yourself of that. It's easy to slip out of that. And this is generally why there were communities, why there were spiritual communities, to help each other to remember. It's very difficult to do this by oneself. In fact, the time-honored technique was that you had to take yourself out of this world, out of the society, to some cave, to some mountain, to some desert in order to do it. The appearance of the urban yogi is very rare in human history. Buddha or Jesus could walk back into town, but there aren't many. So that it isn't that one seeks the inner directed opposed to the outer directed, but that this is a structure which one has to see the full interplay. This inference would not be warranted, that the inner is superior to the outer. More should not be read into the terms than is intended. At every step of theory making, the investigator remains in the grip of his terms. Notice the strength of language. At every step of theory making, I don't know if your minds are not following this, the Greek word theoria meant an angle of vision, a point of view. So a theory is what I understand from this perspective. So that he's writing here, and Reisman's very conscious, I must tell you, at every step of theory making, the investigator remains in the grip of his terms. And the modification of terms throughout the progress of the study was evidence of a constant dialectic between the urge to simplify and the urge to take account of everything. It sounds highfalutin. It's very primordial. How primordial? In American Indian society, every time you matured to a new level, you had the right to take a new name. It's like taking into account, by the very language, the essence of the language you use, the symbolic essence, your name, that you have a right now to change that. It's a highly conscious way of understanding, in a primordial mode, that all of the expressive qualities of language are now transformed. This has been highly developed in contemporary linguistics. If you get interested, one of the early geniuses in this area was Noam Chomsky and his generative grammars and so forth. When we have computers with generative grammars, we're going to have a real companion for man. May even replace the dog as a best pal. The way that they're styled now, they're just super idiots. What is the image, the mythic image of the supercomputer as a companion? The robot who can tell jokes. Yeah, it will come. It will come. And he goes on in this way, but the point here is to understand that inner-directed and outer-directed, these are two complementary matrixes within which role playing, role assigning, role accepting occur. It's similar to introvert extrovert, the Jungian typology, which Jung developed. Incidentally, the archetype for that was in Schiller at the time of Goethe, and Schiller's use of it is actually superior to Jung's derived usage of it. The essay, the book that that appears in for Schiller and is explained is on the title of it, On the Aesthetic Education of Man. And for those of you who have been in this process a long time, you realize we're talking about art. We're talking about aesthetics in our education now. Schiller's On the Aesthetic Education of Man is like one of those declarations of independence, not in a political mode from persons, but in a sociological mode for persons. And it's as important in contemporary self-assessment in social structure terms as the U.S. Constitution might be. It's one of those seminal works. It's like Pico della Mirandola's On the Dignity of Man in the Renaissance. There are seminal works which state the whole situation in terms which are protean, so that one can see at last, at least here, this is everything that counts somehow together in the hopper. It's not the solution, but it's the true anvil upon which any solution that is going to work must be made. Or as one of my teachers used to say, It's a rock you have to put in the building. You cannot build the building without this rock. However you design the building is your concern, but this rock must go in. For this rock is the cornerstone. It's like that. It's like the Sermon on the Mount is the cornerstone of a vision. There are documents like this. Now let's skip over. And Reisman brings out the fact that education has become, in modern society, the place where the inner-directed and outer-directed matrices have their emphasis, not in the home, but in the educational situation. So that the teachers, become the guides de facto for this process. But there are inherent resistances in the situation because the schools are really secular. I'm not talking about a social secularity. I'm talking about a structural basic secularity. They are not religious places. They are not spiritual places. They're marketplaces. The coin of the realm is what counts there. And because of that, there are resistances on the part of teachers to accept or even to recognize their spiritual function. It's like having the position of being a guardian spirit and you're just trying to get a pay raise. There's an incommensurateness that's there, which is why there's such a hunger and desperateness about education today. Unconsciously, the children realize that they're being betrayed by the priest in a very real way. Not in the home, but in the school. It's quite complicated, but I think that most of you can understand. So that he writes, grandmothers as authorities are almost as obsolete as governesses. There is no room for them in the modern apartment, nor can they any more than the children themselves find a useful economic role. This is true, incidentally, of grandfathers also, grandmothers and grandfathers. Why is this of concern? Because it's the grandparent generation that are a source of the bringing together of inner and outer directed. It's like in American Indian culture, when you deal with spiritual education, you don't go to your mother and your father, but you go to your grandmother and your grandfather. And in the largest sense, you go to grandfather and grandmother, grandmother earth, grandfather sky. If you cannot find your way to your grandmother, you will have no connection whatsoever with your granddaughter. In other words, what you produce will be a mule, a psychological mule. Yes, your children come out of you in a way, but they are not able to have children. So you will have no grand daughter generation, no grandson generation, psychologically speaking. That what you give birth to cannot give birth, has lost the creative insight, and is a dead end. And as you know, one rule of nature, if the limb does not blossom, is not able to blossom in fruit, then it withers and dies. It's a natural law. So grandmothers as authorities are almost as obsolete as governesses. There's no room for them in the modern apartment, nor can they, any more than the children themselves, find a useful economic role. Nevertheless, they endure, concomitant with the increased longevity of the later population phases. I don't know if you've been to modern nursing homes and seeing the travail of unfulfilled grandmothers and grandfathers by the million. About 6 years ago, I tried to get a program of donating tapes of my lectures and other lectures to these homes, just so that they would have something to, like a fire of an alive voice around which to sit once a week or something like that, and was met with terminal resistance. Why? Because you're going to remind them that life is beautiful and human values are beautiful, and we're trying to anesthetize them so they'll die quietly. Don't get me started. The increased personalization of relationships that other direction brings means that strangers in the home are less and less endurable. So there's not only an alienation of oneself, but others are stereotyped. They're alien too. There's a whole process, a demonic process, if you're interested in that. It's a demonic energy. I don't mean from the devil. I mean it's demonic. The in-law problem, a standard joke in many cultures over many centuries, takes on new meaning, where sensitive, highly individuated people live without characterological defenses against others. Sensitive, highly individuated people live without characterological defenses against others. And so one becomes very fearful of others, especially of others that could really touch you, really influence your life. The old Homeric Greek value for this. You've all heard of xenophobia, the fear of people. Philoxenia, the love of people. Philoxenia was a Greek value, an archaic ancient Greek value from Homeric times. The love of the stranger. The making of a place in your life and in your home so that when strangers come by, when they occur, they have some place to be accepted and welcomed. The philoxenia. But in our time, xenophobia is an epidemic. And especially one doesn't want to have the stranger who could really change our lives. It's a very, very serious problem. And so you can see that Reisman, how truthful language is, it's right on the spot, and if you think about it half a moment, you can look around from that position. It's a 360-degree view. The elimination of the grandmother from a central role in the home is, moreover, symbolic of the rapidity of the changes we are discussing. She is two generations removed from current practices on the frontier of consumption. While the parents try to keep up with their children, both as a means of staying young, selfishly, and as a means of staying influential, authoritatively, this is seldom possible for the grandparents. Hence, their role in the formation of the other-directed character is negligible. And of course, if you don't take into account the grandparent strata, the spiritual element, one is caught up there in a polarity of just feeling arrogantly certain that getting freed from home is the whole show. And so taking pride in being a delinquent, pride in being an outlaw, I'm bad, baby. is the kind of myopic crap that comes in then as the ideal of self-development. And of course, with any perspective at all, you can see what a tragic travesty this is. It's the epitome of the tragic mode. Far from presenting the child with a relatively consistent family portrait, standing in back of the parents and strengthening them. Grandparents stand as emblems of how little one can learn from one's elders about the things that matter. And so in a demonic way, by severing the living relationship, the grandmothers and grandfathers, the grandparent generation, become silly and frivolous and withered and irrelevant, actually become that. And so the children who are arrogantly busy being fashionably bad in terms of their parents, we'll hear someone saying that the grandparents are important. They'll say, those, look at them. I don't want to do that. I don't want to get old. And just confirms them more in their compulsive need to remain babyish, or at least maybe to remain young, or at least maybe to remain adolescent. One has got to be sexually active in one's rebellion. But hope don't grow up. I hope I don't grow up. So you can see that this is a protean issue that we're dealing with here. What is the handle on it? The importance of the roles being understood in their complete actual structural function. We have to be able to understand, not throw them out self-righteously, but to understand how they weave together a pattern of psyche. For it's only in terms of that woven, completed pattern of psyche that we can finally come to entertain the full resonance of who we are. And who we are has to take that into account. So he writes here, a parallel development removes another set of parent surrogates who played an important role in earlier periods. The older brothers or sisters who, like sophomores, hazed the younger in subjecting them to the family pattern of discipline. Today, the older children, if any there are frequently more willing to earn cash as babysitters than to supervise the training of their own younger brothers and sisters. The lure of a job may get children to work outside their homes. This still makes sense to them. But within their own home, they are the privileged guests in a rather second-rate hotel, a hotel whose harassed but smiling managers they put under constant pressure for renovation. This was written 40 years ago. And you can see it's just become exacerbated since. Reisman wrote this book to say this is true of the United States now, it'll be true of the world soon. Why? Because these are universal structures. This is what happens. It doesn't matter. It finally doesn't matter what cultural heritage you come from, this structural grinder will reprocess you. You can have the same problems in China today. You could read David Reisman out loud in China today, and they would understand. Or in Japan, or in South Africa, wherever in the world. Because the whole world now is in this kind of a situation. One important authority, however, remains. It's the only authority that remains intact, though it has been misused. It's the Achilles heel of the demonic down spiral of the whole process. It's the only entry point left. In the armor of illusion and delusion, there's only one place left open, the Achilles heel. Education, the teacher. We're long past religious or political reform. We're so sophisticated and the thing has devolved so far that any religious energy, any political energy, is just fodder for the mill, grist for the mill. The compulsory habit of grinding up experience for our own aggrandizement now co-opts anything that can be done, except one area that's left, education. And the reason education wasn't fully co-opted is that it was so misused before, it wasn't seen as a threat. It wasn't seen as a possibility. He writes, one important authority, however, remains. A proxy parent, whose power has probably increased as a consequence of the shift to other direction. This is the school teacher. And we now turn to a fuller exploration of the change in her role. He stylizes it her because this is 1950, and he's speaking mostly of younger children. That is universally true, I'm sure occurred to him, but he uses the her. Now, I am not going to take time to go into this, but I will Xerox off these pages, make copies for you, and next week I will give you these further pages. But what we need to shift to today are some comments here by Reisman, which I've jotted down, and then go into the Shiva Dionysius material just for a little bit. Here's some quotations from The Lonely Crowd later on. Is it possible that the middle and upper middle class man of our day goes out of his way to create a series of political demons that exist only because his obsolete belief confirms their existence? In other words, the thought here, the insight, not just in terms of politics, but in terms of all of our experience, that we go out of our way to create projections just so we can have the satisfaction of accepting or rejecting those projections. Creating your own addictive heaven. The answer to that is yes. Two more quotes. Here's the second of three. In The Lonely Crowd, part two suggests that for the more privileged classes in America, it is probably as important to feel free as to be free. In fact, in the delusory arrogance of egotism, it's more important to feel free than to be free. Why? Because one is thrown back to the realm of feeling, and the realm of thinking is excluded as an uncomfortable intrusion that forces all kinds of decisions which are uncomfortable in their feeling when they first come up. So one is thrown back to feeling, of course. Where are we most comfortable in feeling? In a kind of adolescence. We encourage a continuous turmoil because it's much more comfortable than any kind of subtle situation that might make us see what really is going on. So that part two, read this again, part two suggests that for the more privileged classes in America, and now it is true worldwide everywhere, he's writing from data from 50 years ago, and it's come a long way now, it is probably as important to feel free as to be free. Part three attempts to come to grips with the practical implications and limitations of that approach to life and politics. It begins with the essentially psychological and philosophical postulate that adjustment, no matter how comfortable it appears to be, is never freedom. Beyond adjustment, gotte, gone. Beyond adjustment to the prevailing mode of conformity, beyond obedience to or fascination by the peers, lies the possibility of autonomy. Autonomy arises when men and women use the opportunity presented by the loose fit of social character, which is never all of character. Now this, quote, loose fit of social character is becoming conscious that what one is doing here is a role. The usefulness, the Greek term here is praktike, the praktike, the practicality of becoming conscious of roles as structures in our sociological expression of ourselves, gives us this situation of a loose fit. We have a little bit of room to move around and begin the process, the Greek term here again. Why do we use Greek terms? Because they're the archetypal language of this whole process. The Greek term is metanoia. You begin to find that you, when you're conscious of a role, that this is not all of you. And the all of you begins to be able to turn a little bit inside of the role. And eventually what one wants to do is to develop this